The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Here goes recruits, sir.
Can't hear a thing.
Where were you born?
What?
Where were you born?
I don't know what he's saying.
Where were you born?
Oh, born! Upstairs in the front room.
Fine soldiers for the Coast Artillery wouldn't know a shell from a boat. Remember your place. What's wrong with you men?
We're hungry. We ain't eaten in a week.
Oh, that's it. Sergeant, get these men some food.
Yes, sir.
Now to continue. Were you born in this country?
What?
Were you born in this country?
No, Milwaukee.
Would you fight for this great republic and...
Republican? No, I'm a Democrat.
Not me. I'm a pedestrian.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, December 17th, 2025. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
Republican, Democrat, pedestrian. Wow, what a great description for the political and cultural divide in America. In fact, I'm beginning to think that the word pedestrian may be a far better term to describe what we've been calling the normies or the NPCs, you know, the non-player characters, that massive group of political identities who haven't got a clue about what's going on in America politically. Hence, the pedestrian views of the average voter. In this context, my handy Funkin' Wagnalls dictionary defines pedestrian as pertaining to common people, plebeian, commonplace, prosaic, dull. It also defines plebeian as of or pertaining to the common people, especially those of ancient Rome, common or vulgar, anyone who is coarse or vulgar. And the word prosaic is defined as unimaginative. You get the general idea. So, if your views are pedestrian, thank you for staying out of politics because unimaginative, coarse, vulgar, dull, plebeian people don't know left from right. And above all, do not think objectively. Unfortunately, political pedestrians are not the only victims of a failure to think objectively. There are many on the right claiming to be the sole arbiters of objectivity and justifying that claim on purely subjective grounds. To address this contradiction and what it means to think objectively is the overarching theme of our discussion today, which begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, over the past week or so, I quite accidentally found myself listening to two separate podcasts that got me so frustrated I just had to get this off my chest. One featured a presentation delivered by Nick Freitas to a university crowd, and the other featured Tucker Carlson and Matt Walsh in a discussion that very much echoed what was said in the presentation by Nick Freitas. And given that most of my commentary today will be a response, both positive and negative, to these discussions, let's get right into these very compelling discussions, beginning first with the speech delivered by Nick Freitas. Now, this is a presentation that both delighted and disappointed me. Delighted because I pretty much agreed with all of the speaker's conclusions. Disappointed because I disagreed with his justifications for his conclusions. Now, for those unfamiliar with Nick Freitas, this brief Wikipedia entry describes him as, quote, an American politician and social media influencer. A Republican, he has been a member of the Virginia House of Delegates since 2016. He unsuccessfully sought the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate in 2018, narrowly losing in the primary election to Corey Stewart. He was a Republican nominee in the 2020 election to represent Virginia's 7th Congressional District in the United States House of Representatives, which he lost 49% to 51% to Abigail Spanberger, the incumbent Democratic Congresswoman. Following the September 11 terrorist attacks, Freitas joined the U.S. Army Special Forces, the Green Beret, and served two tours in Iraq. And after being honorably discharged in 2009, Freitas moved to Culpeper County, Virginia in 2010 and served for a service-disabled veteran-owned company, end quote. So here, on both sides of our upcoming bumper, is Nick Freitas from a December 6th posting by the Young Americas Foundation.
My name is Miguel Muniz. I'm the president of the Berkeley College Republicans and the chairman of the California College Republicans. In the aftermath of Charlie Kirk's assassination, no one's monologue was more moving than that of Freitas. In a time where many were reaching out for fake unity with a movement that wants them dead, Nick called out the ideology that's captured the far left for what it is. A cancerous growth in the United States that sustains itself by sucking the lifeblood of its host nation. Or in his words, I don't want to stand in solidarity with the other side of the aisle. And without further ado, please join your hands for Nick J. Freitas.
Well, I was asked to talk about the left and whether or not the left is inherently violent. Because when a lot of us saw Charlie Kirk get murdered, that was horrific in and of itself. What I didn't anticipate was the reaction on the left to Charlie getting murdered. And the sentiment that I felt on the day he was murdered was essentially just what was said. We had all these people crying for solidarity, and I'm like, wait a second. Wait a second. I'm watching people openly celebrate this man being murdered. And I spent a lot of time trying to make sense of it. Because that is one thing that I think is missing from a lot of our conversations, is trying to genuinely understand opposing perspectives. I will tell you right now, I have never bought in to what I believe is a truly ridiculous notion that truth is subjective. This idea that, well, there's no truth. There's just your truth or my truth. That is so absurd on its face that I can't believe anybody would utter it, especially someone claiming to be a well-educated person. One of the things that I commonly ask students is, when anybody tells you that there's no such thing as objective truth, what is the very next thing you should ask them? Is that true? Because if they say no, well, great, then don't believe them. If they say yes, still don't believe them because they just said it's objectively true that there's no such thing as objective truth, which is, of course, a contradiction. Now, I would have thought that that's the sort of thing that would end a debate right there, like, ooh, yeah, I really screwed up here. You caught me in a contradiction. I feel a little bit silly. Let me reevaluate my position. But no. Instead, when I appeal to things like the law of non-contradiction, I'm told, well, that's a tool of oppression. That's a tool of a patriarchy. That's an attribute of whiteness. And the more I thought about that, the more I realized that really is the crux of this. I think the biggest ethical conundrum is postmodernism. I believe that if we actually raise a generation of Americans that truly believe that truth is purely subjective, that is a far greater threat than any of the potential issues that we're facing right now, because that will strike at the core of our very reasoning, our ability to differentiate between right and wrong, because ultimately, if truth is subjective, there is no right or wrong. And if there is no right or wrong, or there is no truth, then what I can allow myself to do to another human being is essentially endless. That's the sort of moral framework that can justify just about anything. And the more I was watching the reactions on social media, the more I was watching the reactions by elected officials, by mainstream media personalities, essentially trying to justify while Charlie was still on the ground how this was probably his fault. I remembered that paper. But what really put it over the edge for me is when I saw Destiny, an incredibly popular left-wing YouTuber, go on Piers Morgan and say, if conservatives wanted Charlie Kirk alive, Donald Trump shouldn't have won a second term. Conservatives should be afraid to go out in public saying the things that they say and believing the things they believe. Hassan Piker said something similar. And again, my initial reaction was, oh, it's violence you want. Okay, cocky YouTuber. If you want violence, I know how that game is played. I wasn't always a social media personality. I wasn't always an elected official. Long before that, I was in Army Special Forces. If you want to start engaging in violence, okay. It was my oldest daughter, as I was entertaining these thoughts out loud, it was my oldest daughter that stopped me and said, yeah, but Dad, we're not permitted to return evil for evil. We're commanded to overcome evil with good. But she was right. Why was she right? Because truth is objective. Now, for the longest time, I can remember telling people, guys, it's getting bad. The sort of debates that we're having, the nature of the debates we're having, the nature of the language that is being used has changed exponentially from the time that I entered office in 2016 to right now. I'm like, guys, it is getting really bad. And the response that I always get is, that's a couple of crazies. That's a couple of people in their mom's basement that are just on Twitter too long. It's not a big deal. Surely the person that I know from high school or that I went to college with or that I work with, or that I see at the local coffee shop, surely that person doesn't think that way. And now, finally, people are waking up to the fact that, no, they might. They might. And they might be polite to you right now because it makes sense to be polite when you're out and about. But don't assume that's what they actually think. And the question is what do we do about that? Now, I will admit, and I'm very grateful to the students here, both with YAF and the College Republicans. When I came here today, and they said, we're going to go table, and I'm like, oh, this will be interesting. Because the topic we picked was the leftist fascist. And again, it was a little bit provocative on purpose, because I actually wanted to have a discussion about what fascism actually is. And interestingly enough, I got to have that conversation a few times a day because students would come over and be like, this seems ridiculous. What do you mean by that? I was like, oh, well, let's discuss fascism. Let's discuss what it was in 1919 and 1920 and 1921. Let's discuss how it shifted in 1932 and 33 and 34 and 35. Let's have that discussion. And then I'm going to ask you a question once we get done discussing the Italian fascist platform and you are shocked to find out that they actually initially campaigned on minimum wage and an 8-hour work week, and universal suffrage, and the confiscation of money from the super wealthy, and the expropriation of war profiteering funds, and you realize that I just named off a bunch of left-wing issues and causes. And then I'm going to ask you, did you know that was a part of fascism? And the answer is always, I never heard that before. Gosh. And yet, I see the term bandied about by educated people at a premier university in the United States. The reason why that gives me some hope is because they were willing to sit down and actually have a polite conversation. And so maybe Charlie was still on to something. But the other part of this, before I get into Q&A, that I want to make really clear is something did change when Charlie was murdered. Because enough of us started to recognize how bad it had really gotten. Enough of us has started to recognize that when I say that this is a war between diametrically opposed worldviews, I don't mean it's a war simply against other people. My faith commands me to look at other human beings as created in the image of God. But let me make something very clear. Forgiveness is freely given. Reconciliation requires repentance, and repentance requires acknowledgement. My faith may command me to overcome evil with good. It does not require me to tolerate, accommodate, or celebrate evil. It commands me to abhor it, and I will. I'm tired of it being comfortable in my presence. For too long, on the right, we've been obsessed with comfort. And by that I mean when situations or when controversial topics came up, we wanted to talk in hushed tones or just take it out of the public square altogether, unless it was in an appropriate venue in which to discuss these things. And what I've noticed is the left has no such compunction. They feel morally justified to talk about whatever they want and whatever the tone they want, regardless of how it makes any of us feel. And as we strive to try to maintain the peace and regulate our own speech or thoughts or actions, for fear of causing offense, we've created a society where now people have recognized that, offense can be used as a substitute for an argument. I don't have to engage with anything you're saying if I simply claim offense. Then you're obligated to be quiet. And what we found is when you start to allow people to play that game, they find a litany of things to be offended about that no sane individual should be offended about. So as I will not attempt to cause offense, but if I fulfill my obligation to speak the truth with gentleness and respect, and you're still offended, your problem is with the truth, not with me.
That was quite a remarkable commentary on a topic rarely discussed in the context we just heard. So here's a quick review before we move on, because I generally agreed with Nick's following assertions that the left is inherently violent because it is, and that the truth is objective. And I loved it when he said that to say that there is no objective truth is a contradiction that denies its own premise, which again led to his acknowledgement of the law of non-contradiction. And I just about fell on the floor in shocked delight when Freitas said that the belief that the truth is purely subjective is a far greater threat than any other, because that will strike at the core of our reasoning, ultimately to be able to choose between right and wrong. Wow. By this point, I'm thinking that Nick must be an objectivist, or at least a fan of Ayn Rand, given that he's using the same terms that she would use. And he understood that fascism is on the left, and above all, although he didn't put it in these words, that the left and right are incompatible political polarities, when he said, America is embroiled in a war between diametrically opposed worldviews which cannot peacefully coexist with one another, and that there's no point in pretending anymore that Americans are one people. And in a quick point form summary of Nick Freitas' political views as cited in Wikipedia, I supported them all. He's called for the repeal of Obamacare, supports the construction of a wall on the Mexican border, urged school board officials to disregard Obama's order to allow transgender males into women's restrooms, arguing that no one gets to arbitrarily redefine what gender means. He praised Donald Trump for being a stronger leader in his first year than Barack Obama had been in 8 years. He's called for the abolishment of the federal income tax, replacing it with a national sales tax. He's opposed to minimum wage laws, supports marijuana decriminalization, and opposes further gun control proposals. On all these counts, Nick Freitas has it just right. But here's where things really start to get interesting. The Q&A segment of his presentation began earlier. And while I still agree with a lot of his comments and observations, on the topic of objectivity, it appears we might have a fundamental disagreement.
Okay, we will now open it up for Q&A. All right, our first question.
I believe the political spectrum is more like a scale. The more you have to the extreme left, the more you're going to see people pushing to the far right. So what do you have to say to the people that feel inclined, the right-wing people that feel inclined to side more with the far right?
It's a good question. I don't even like the term far right to describe what I'm seeing going on, to be perfectly honest, because there's elements of it that there's elements of what I'm seeing going on the right that is heavily authoritarian. And it's important to understand something. When we talk about right or left, we get those terms from the French Revolution, right? And there's a right and left, or what we might call a conservative and liberal tradition on the continent of Europe, but there's a separate one in the UK, and there's a separate one in the United States. And so for anybody in the United States that's going to claim the mantle of truly right wing, or whatever else it might be, or conservative, understand that that comes with a tradition that is rooted within the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and what the founders discussed as a society. And so insofar as you're going to go down this route of looking for greater authoritarianism, just understand it's not in the American political tradition. You're picking something else. Now, to the extent that you still want to pick it, the question I'm going to ask is, what's the standard for truth? Because that's been one of my biggest frustrations, is that more and more I see arguments on the right now, and I will see the comments section fill up with, oh, you got your $7,000 check from Israel, or, oh, the Qataris paid you off. And it's like, shut up. Engage with the argument. Demonstrate what is wrong with the argument. If that is not an animating feature of American conservatism, we're already losing. Being able to come up with logically consistent and rational arguments for what we believe, or engaging with other people's arguments using the laws of logic, is critical. If we start to engage in the same sort of quasi-identity politics where it's just my tribe against yours, I don't know what I'm fighting for at that point. What I would encourage people to do is, again, are you just looking for a tribe to fight for? Or are you looking for the truth? Again, what's always been so powerful to me, no matter what I faced in life, is that my identity never came exclusively from being a Green Beret or a politician. It came from being a Christian. I belong to Christ. He gets to dictate the terms with respect to right and wrong and truth. And so insofar as I start to violate that, there is a very, very clear line that can bring correction to my thinking. But if you're willing to outsource that to a mob, then you will go wherever the mob leads. And so that's what I would put to young men. That's what I put to anybody that's considering that way of thinking. What is the standard of truth, and what is it that you're really looking for? Because quite frankly, the best soldiers I ever served with were not the best soldiers because they hated what was in front of them. It was because they loved what they were defending. And that's what we need, more people that truly love and believe in what they're actually defending.
Hi, Nick, fellow Army vet here. Nothing as illustrious as your career, but thank you for your service.
No, thank you for yours. Thank you for choosing the right branch.
Yeah. So my question's about Antifa. I and a lot of my buddies over the last 7 years have dodged bricks from them. I was feet away when I saw a bike lock thrown at somebody on our side, and Antifa just slinks away right into the crowd. In your opinion, is the current admin doing enough to combat them?
I think they're doing more than anybody has done before, but I'd like to see more. They're a subversive communist element, and they've demonstrated time and time again that whenever they're present and organized, they're probably going to be the ones instigating violence.
That's my greater question, is that if our government doesn't do enough to stop them, I'm worried that more vigilantism is going to happen, which is not going to be good for anybody.
It will. Here's the problem. Conservatives are always worried about using government power, right? Because we're naturally skeptical of government. But the reason why government power exists is because there are legitimate roles for government. And one of the primary reasons why we have a government in the first place, I don't know about you, I don't want a government to take care of my health care, my education. I don't want it to be telling me what to do with my life. You know what I would like the government to do? I don't know, provide for public safety. That seems like it'd be a pretty good thing to focus on. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never paid any taxes thinking, I really hope this goes to a trans opera in Colombia. Right? Like, it's never once crossed my mind. All right, but keeping my streets safe, yeah, that is something that's a legitimate function. So if conservatives do not legitimately use the government power they have in order to fulfill legitimate functions of government, what you're telling both sides something. You're telling Antifa you can get away with it in perpetuity. And you're telling people like us, we're not going to protect you. Well, we're not going to get kicked around forever, are we?
Thank you again for doing this. Thank you for coming out here. So you talked about moral objectivity and values. And even though I'm an atheist, liberal Democrat, I still think values like family values and modesty are important for creating strong moral societies. And I know the left has abandoned these issues. They don't talk or try to uphold them. And even though I feel like there is a part of the patriotic moderate left that I identify with that believes in it, they don't talk about it. Yeah. But on the right, I see that these values are only defended through a religious lens, which may not work for atheists or people who are very staunchly in favor of separation of church and state. What kind of non-religious framework do you have for encouraging these values without legislating them? And where do you think that moral objective standard should come from?
So to be honest, so my answer to your first question with respect to what is my like non-religious standard for morality or whatnot, I don't have one. And the only reason I say that is because I don't think objective morality exists outside of an objective moral lawgiver. That's not to say you can't have morality. It just can't be objective. This is one of the things where I think atheists have to confront this notion on whether or not they're willing to accept in the world that to talk in moral categories is to assume the ought. And that's very, very different than what atheism provides. Atheism generally provides, it tries to provide an explanation, sometimes from materialism, sometimes from other things. But if we're all here because of time plus chance plus matter, then I don't know that you can claim objective morality. You can just say, I find this to be more useful, whether it's for survival or for civilization or for wealth or whatever else it is. So it's not that I don't think atheists can engage in moral behavior. I just don't think their worldview is capable of explaining that moral behavior in an objective sense. And so for that reason, I can't appeal to a morality outside of what I believe is the source of objective morality, which I believe is Christianity. And a lot of times people will struggle with that. Well, that seems very exclusive. Yes, because every worldview is exclusive. Right? An atheistic worldview is exclusive. Truth, by definition, is exclusive. And so the only thing that I can do is I can advocate for that which I believe to be true. And I can certainly listen to people with different perspectives or religious faiths or beliefs or no faith. But ultimately, I'm always going to come back to arguing from that as, again, my starting point, my epistemological principle from which everything else is derived. Because I think it's the only thing that provides a sort of internal consistency with respect to human experience. So, It's not to say that I don't want to be able to work with people who may disagree with me on that point, or maybe even share in certain values. But my goal is always going to be to want to bring you on the team, right? Because I believe it's true. And I want to say this, because I went through a period of really challenging my faith intellectually, and one of the things that I thought was so incredible about the Christianity specifically, was this idea that everyone I've ever met has been interested in love and justice. And one of the common criticisms of Christianity is, if God is loving, then why is there so much evil in the world? Now, the flippant response to that is, well, atheists don't even have a category for evil, so you're borrowing from Christianity to even use the word. But I think a more in-depth response would be this. Whenever I talk to anybody that prides themselves on being a strong thinker and their freedom, their individual autonomy, I always ask, can love be compelled or does it have to be voluntary? And they used to always say, well, it has to be voluntary. Okay, well, if it's voluntary, then you have to have an option to reject it. And when I read about the Garden of Eden, I actually think it's there's so much packed into that story that just gets dismissed as like a Bible story. So if you think about Garden of Eden, it's God creating man and woman, and saying, you have everything you could ever want. There's just one rule. And then he doesn't hide it. He doesn't say, hey, don't eat from that tree, but I'm not going to tell you why. He says, don't eat from that tree because on the day you'll die. So it's like, it's toxic, it's deadly, don't touch it. But look, you have everything else. Perfect. and we broke the rule, right? So now there's injustice, and there's been a whole slew of it since. So the question is if you're a loving God, how do you reconcile? How do you remain a just God and a loving God at the same time? Because if God just forgives everything, well, then justice is not served, right? And we can't even really call that loving too, right? Because loving requires an element of justice. And so the only thing in my mind that I can make sense of that seems to repair that divide is Christ taking on that burden, because he's the only one qualified to be able to take on that sacrifice. So the justice is served and love is also achieved through that reconciliation, but you still have a choice. And as I look at everything in my life and searching for meaning and purpose and love and justice and truth, I constantly go back to that, and it's like nothing I have ever seen or studied makes more sense to me now than that.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And I don't know about you, but that didn't make any sense to me at all. And what a disappointment all of this faith-based thinking was when being used to demonstrate or prove the truth is objective. It was a complete train wreck of illogical non sequiturs. Not only that, but I think that his interpretation of certain religious stories is somewhat lacking as well, at least to the best of my understanding. Religion is primarily metaphor and allegory. It is an abstract way of conveying certain values associated with it, but not an objective means of arriving at objective values. So when Freitas talked about the Garden of Eden as a literal existent and failed to abstract on what the tree represented, I think he even missed the point from the standpoint of religion. He says, "When I read about the Garden of Eden, there's so much packed into the story. You have everything you could ever want. There's just one rule, don't eat from that tree, but we broke the rule, so now there's injustice." Well, as if there was anything that could ever have been called justice in this imaginary Garden of Eden. This was such a superficial interpretation of that story, even I found myself cringing a bit. If someone could have everything they could ever want, then there would be no such thing as want. To desire something, the word want would be meaningless. The idea of wanting something in a state of idyllic having everything, which means not being in a state of want, is a contradiction in terms. Why would you want, and how would you know what to want? It was always my understanding that the tree in question was often referred to as the tree of knowledge, which bore the fruit of knowledge, knowledge of good and evil. And why being able to distinguish between good and evil is considered by so many religious people to be some kind of evil itself has never been adequately explained to me, either subjectively or objectively. But we broke the rule, says Freitas, so now there's injustice. Yeah, knowledge of injustice, not the creation of injustice itself. Injustice is the consequence of a judgment based on certain predetermined principles that define what that justice is. The Garden of Eden is not a place that you'd want to be. What we call injustice would be routine in a garden where all the creatures behave like animals, acting out of ignorance and instinct rather than out of knowledge. The supposed shame experienced by Adam and Eve when they were cast out of the Garden of Eden wasn't because they ate of the fruit of knowledge, having noticed that they were naked, as I hear it expressed, it was the knowledge itself of just how immorally they had been acting prior to knowing that it was so, and I don't think it had anything to do with their being physically naked. That was the cause of their shame, and the solution to their escape from Eden. The story's a metaphor for the birth of objectivity and morality, and as expressed in the Encyclopedia Britannica Online, quote, "The story of the Garden of Eden is a theological use of mythological themes to explain human progression from a state of innocence and bliss to the present human condition of knowledge, of sin, misery, and death." End quote. "I belong to Christ. He gets to dictate the terms with respect to right and wrong and truth," says Freitas in a statement that's about as far from objectivity as you could get. That's a complete statement of faith. But the most disappointing thing about Nick Freitas' response to that last questioner was that not only did he admit to not being able to answer the question, he effectively attacked the questioner for being an atheist. I mean, attack the messenger and avoid the message. In responding to the questioner's very well and politely expressed inquiry, what kind of non-religious framework do you have for encouraging these values without legislating them, and where do you think that moral objective standards come from? Well, Freitas outrageously asserts that atheists don't even have a category for evil, so they're borrowing from Christianity if they even use the word. I couldn't believe it. That statement is so wrong on so many levels and speaks to the ridiculous notion that Christians have that somehow atheism is a philosophy or some kind of competing ideology of some sort. It is neither and never has been, and I've pontificated on this basic reality so many times it's becoming a chant. Atheism is merely a rejection of theism and nothing more. And when it comes to left and right, you'll find Christians, atheists, Muslims, Jews, and people of various sundry belief systems on both sides of that polarity. Forgive him, Lord, for Nick knows not what he is saying. Christians have it backwards when they see Christianity as the source of morality. The source of morality is determined by objective rules of reality, and the fact that Christianity may have adopted many of these rules, faith issues aside, is why, to at least the degree that Nick Freitas sees it, Christians and people of any peaceful belief system who acknowledge these realities are able to peacefully coexist. But to actually answer the atheistic question about where do moral objective standards come from, well, here is atheist Ayn Rand, whose entire philosophy she named objectivism, to explain what objectivity is and how it is determined. And I quote, "Objectivity is both a metaphysical and an epistemological concept. It pertains to the relationship of consciousness to existence. Metaphysically, it is the recognition of the fact that reality exists independent of any perceiver's consciousness. Epistemologically, it is the recognition of the fact that the perceiver's consciousness must acquire knowledge of reality by certain means, reason, in accordance with certain rules, logic. This means that although reality is immutable, and in any given context, only one answer is true, the truth is not automatically available to a human consciousness and can be obtained only by a certain mental process which is required of every man who seeks knowledge, that there is no substitute for this process, no escape from the responsibility for it, no shortcuts, no special revelations to privileged observers, and there can be no such thing as a final quote-unquote authority in matters pertaining to human knowledge. Metaphysically, the only authority is reality. Epistemologically, one's own mind. The first is the ultimate arbiter of the second." The concept of objectivity contains the reasons why the question, who decides what's right or wrong, is wrong. Nobody decides. Nature does not decide. It merely is. Man does not decide in issues of knowledge. He merely observes that which is. When it comes to applying his knowledge, man decides what he chooses to do, according to what he's learned, remembering that the basic principle of rational action in all aspects of human existence is, nature, to be commanded, must be obeyed. And this means that man does not create reality, and can achieve his values only by making his decisions consonant with the facts of reality. It is axiomatic concepts that identify the precondition of knowledge, the distinction between existence and consciousness, between reality and the awareness of reality, between the object and the subject of cognition. Axiomatic concepts are the foundations of objectivity, end quote. Now, to carry on the confusion over how objectivity and truth are determined, here are two more subjectivists trying to speak objectively about objectivity and truth, namely Tucker Carlson and Matt Walsh in their December 12 conversation that also included their perspectives on the nature of left and right.
You know everybody involved personally, or most of them involved in all these dramas on the right, and I think the way that you've handled it is just so impressive. So thank you for that. But first, like, what is going on? There is a civil war, probably not too strong.
Yeah, I mean, this has been it's been a really awful. I think for everybody, and a lot of this drama obviously goes back a long way. But I think after Charlie was killed, it's created this kind of this vacuum, and it's a leadership vacuum, because Charlie was I think the best leader we had on the right. And that's what happens with that's why assassinations happen. That's why people do them,
because they work.
Because it works, yeah. Because they work. On a kind of national scale, the tragedy is that the strategy of assassination has been proven effective again, as it has all throughout human history. And so now, this guy who was this. I think to an extent that none of us fully realized was the glue that was holding everything together on the right, holding this whole crazy coalition together. It turns out it was like one guy who was doing this. And now he's gone, and it kind of feels like everything's coming undone, to be honest with you. And there's this, so there's all the fighting that's going on, and that is all different from, disagreement and saying, I disagree with this person.
Of course, this is intuitively obvious, I think, to normal people. What I'm so struck by is how this doesn't just remind me of like medieval Europe, it reminds me of 2023. But it's the same impulse to publicly denounce people, to destroy people. And that's why I got to the point where, after many years of disagreeing with the left, I really hated the left, because I find that so totalitarian and scary. I just can't even believe that less than a year later, the right is doing the same thing. Like, what is going on?
I still believe, I'm old-fashioned, so call me old-fashioned, but I still believe that the left, that leftism as an ideology, is the enemy. It is the problem. It's the thing that we're fighting against. It's the thing that I've always fought against. It's why I'm doing any of this. It's the only reason I'm on camera right now. The only reason that I'm doing any of this. The only reason I got into this, whatever it is we're doing, whatever this business is, this fight, it's the reason I'm in it, is to oppose leftism.
How do you define leftism?
Well, I would define it, modern leftism is, first of all, moral relativism. It's the idea that I have my own truth. You know, there is no truth. There's no truth. I have my own. And so I think, to me, that's the core of the thing. And I think that if you're a relativist, then you are a leftist. Doesn't matter what else you believe. You could be a relativist and be anti-immigration. You could be a relativist and believe in gun rights. Now, I think most relativists don't end up there. But even if you did, you're still a leftist, because you reject truth. So that's what it is. At its core. And also, leftism, not really also, but as an extension of that, as an outgrowth of that, leftism opposes civilization, and it opposes Western civilization in particular. There could be a lot of disagreement. If we agree that, okay, we need to preserve all, as conservatives, what are we conserving? Well, to me, it's easy. We're conserving Western civilization. We're conserving American identity. We're conserving the sanctity of human life. We're conserving the family. We're conserving marriage. That's what we're conserving. And if you agree with me on that, then we're on the same side, as far as I'm concerned. Now, we might have a lot of disagreements about how to conserve those things.
Exactly.
And those disagreements might be even brutal and bitter at times. But if that is the argument, then we're all on the same side arguing. If we're arguing about whether those things should be conserved, well, then if you're on the other side of that argument, then we're not on the same side at all. We're in two different universes. Like, I don't even know what universe you're living in. And the divide, I think, ideologically in this country is so vast and so deep and so unbridgeable that we may as well be living in different universes. We may as well be aliens from different galaxies trying to live on a planet together, and it's just not working out. That's what it feels like. And so for me, that's where the fight is. Maybe there's a whole other category we should be talking about, because we're talking about, oh, left, right, conservative, right, liberal. Then you also have, though, politicians who often, not always, but often are neither, and they don't right. they don't have an ideology.
For sure.
And their ideology is control and power, and that's what they care
what
about.
What percentage would you say fall into that category?
95%.
It feels that way,
well,
doesn't it?
I'll amend that. I think it used to be 95% I want control and power. I think now it's more like, and this is even worse, now it's like 70% want control and power, and then you've got another 20% who they're just there because they want attention, like the Jasmine Crocketts.
Right.
They're just there because they want to be influencers. So one success that I think that you're starting to see recently is that the left used to get a lot of mileage out of obviously not engaging with arguments, but just labeling them. They would just label the argument. And so they would say their way of engaging with the argument is say, well, argument's not wrong or right. I don't care about that. The argument is an ist or ism. The argument is racist. The argument is you know, whatever, bigoted, Islamophobic, whatever, anti-Semitic. So that they used to get a lot of mileage out of that. And I think what's happening now is that people are saying, well, I don't care about the labels. Like, you can say whatever label
exactly.
you want.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean anything to me. And the reason it doesn't mean anything to me is it's not my fault. It's your fault. When you decided that everything fits under that label, the label doesn't mean anything anymore.
Exactly.
To go back to the question of what to do about it. Well, I guess I don't know why I'm going back to it, because I don't have the answer. But I think the only thing that can be done is for all of us, if you're on the right, to go back to some of the basics that we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. Like, what is it that we want?
Exactly.
What is it that we actually want?
What's the real catechism here? What does it mean to be on the right?
Exactly. What are we? It's the classic question about conservatives. What are you trying to conserve? It's a good question. You should be able to answer that. What are you trying to conserve? And everybody needs to ask themselves that and come up with an answer. Write your list. Write it out if you have to. Whatever. Come up with your list.
I'm going to do this. This is my
right.
calling right here.
And everyone should have their list. And then we should compare notes. And if our lists match up, like, we want the same things, we're trying to conserve and preserve the same things, then the only way forward is with that, is for us to realize that, like, let's reorient towards that. Make that the goal. And remember that even when we disagree, we're going to have disagreements, but we're only disagreeing about how to do this thing that we both want done. And I think that's the way forward. Now, on the other hand, maybe you start looking at your list and you realize that, well, I actually don't even want the same things as these people. Okay, well, then we're not on the same side. And that's very clarifying, too. I've given my list of what it is that I want to conserve and preserve.
Can you, in an abbreviated form, just run through it really quick one more time? Because I think, well, I agreed with it.
Abbreviated is always in trouble for me.
Well, no, you don't have to abbreviate it, but you just say it again. Like, what are the things you're saying? There's left, right, what even, I don't even know what that means anymore, but like, people who share your values believe what?
They believe in objective truth.
Yeah. Can I just add one caveat? I'm not always convinced I know what the objective truth is. I've certainly been wrong, but I know it exists.
Right, exactly. And that's exactly the point. We can disagree about what the truth is. We're going to have those disagreements.
Right.
But we have to be able to agree that there is a truth.
Right.
To begin with.
Exactly.
And when you're talking to someone who's a moral relativist, they're on the left, you can't even agree on that. So there's no conversation to be had. And even above the truth, the reason why there's an objective truth is that there is God. There is God. And he has designed the universe and everything and everybody in it. And that's the source. That's the wellspring of truth.
Sum it up. You could say objective truth derived from a belief that this is all created. We are not the creators.
Exactly. But in America, as American conservatives, what are we trying to conserve? We're trying to conserve American identity, our national identity. We're trying to conserve the institution of the family, which is the foundation of the country and of civilization. We're trying to conserve the institution of the marriage, which is the foundation of the family. So this is the foundation of the foundation.
Which is the foundation of American identity.
Right. And we're trying to conserve all those things. And then at a broader level, we're trying to conserve Western civilization itself.
It feels like a lot of our politics is artificial. It's inorganic. It was these divisions in some cases are real. In some cases, they were created in order to get us to not see that we have a lot in common with other people. Does that make sense?
I think so. Look, and if someone, the words left and right are labels that we put on things.
Well, people have always said that, but I never really believed it. That's bullshit. But
it's a way of categorizing and organizing things so we can speak about them coherently. But sometimes the labels that we use, we have to shift it over. There might be people but anyone who you've talked to who we would say is on the left who agrees with all that, well, then I would say they're not on the left.
Well, I agree.
They might even think they still are, but they're not. And so they're over on this side, and you can kind of call it whatever you want. I'm saying right, conservative. We could come up with any team name we want.
No, you can't. Having already identified the enemy as being on the left, why would you possibly entertain any other label than right? And especially after having just said that the words left and right are labels providing a way of categorizing and organizing so we can speak about them coherently. Which, by the way, was yet another excellent reason for regarding left and right as political polarities. Now, as far as organizing a team, that's called a political party if you plan to affect the government in any significant way. But Matt Walsh had it just right when he observed that leftism as an ideology is the enemy, defined as moral relativism where there's no objective truth. But then, just like Nick Freitas did earlier, Walsh completely steered away from objective truth by arguing that the reason why there is an objective truth is because of God. He has designed the universe and everything and everybody in it, and that's the wellspring of truth. Objective truth derived by the belief that we are not the creators. So I'm thinking objective truth derived by a belief that we are not the creators of the universe? Whoever believed that in the first place? I mean, that would be self-evident, wouldn't it? I don't need faith or belief to arrive at that conclusion. I understand it. And how would these religious intrinsicists reconcile their intrinsic belief with atheist Ayn Rand, who explained objectively that the basic principle of rational action in all aspects of human existence is nature to be commanded must be obeyed, and that this means that man does not create reality? But Nick Freitas earlier confessed that he was incapable of supporting this non-religious argument of arriving at the same conclusion that he did. I know that so far I've been using the term subjective as the contrast to the objective, mainly because that's how it was framed in the given discussions. And although I might argue that they made a subjective decision to arrive at their conclusions, it was clear from what all of them were saying, Nick Freitas, Tucker Carlson, and Matt Walsh, that their beliefs are ultimately based on intrinsicism. Ayn Rand explained, "There are, in essence, three schools of thought on the nature of the good: the intrinsic, the subjective, and the objective. The intrinsic theory holds that the good is inherent in certain things or actions as such, regardless of their context and consequences. It is a theory that divorces the concept of good from its beneficiaries and the concept of value from the valuer, claiming that the good is good in, by, and of itself. The intrinsic theory holds that the good resides in some sort of reality independent of man's consciousness. If a man believes that the good is intrinsic to certain actions, he will not hesitate to force others to perform them. certainly as we're seeing with all of the Islamist attacks routinely being conducted around the world. And she concludes, it is the intrinsic theory of values that produces a Robespierre, a Lenin, a Stalin, or a Hitler. Subjectivism is the belief that reality is not a firm absolute, but a fluid, plastic, indeterminate realm which can be altered, in whole or in part, by the consciousness of the perceiver. Now, applying the concept of intrinsicism to the field of ethics, author Paul McKeever, in his monumental book, Judge, Philosophy and Freedom in the First Person, on page 503, under the subheading of Divine Command Theories, Intrinsicist Philosophies of Ethics, he explains, and I quote, in divine command theories, one is presented with what are arguably the most obvious and indisputably intrinsicist ethical philosophies. Quite simply, all values are those which are asserted by the divine commander to be values. One's thoughts, feelings, and preferences, in short, one's mind, has nothing whatsoever to do with what is and what is not a value. To the commanded individual, all values intrinsically are values. Accordingly, divine command ethical philosophies are intrinsicist philosophies. End quote. Or, in the words of Nick Freitas, I belong to Christ. He gets to dictate the terms with respect to right and wrong and truth. And that is a commanded individual. God dictates to him. Now, my purpose in bringing all of these definitions and observations to our attention this week is not to attack religious people or their beliefs per se, because I support a lot of their political causes and would continue to do so. But to make it clear that the intrinsicist view of objectivity is not objective, as they are claiming. It is also somewhat divisive in my observation, as constantly evidenced by the willingness of people on the right who identify as atheists to work with people on the right who are religious at the political level where many of their values intersect. But the religious righteous, as I've been calling them, only weaken the right by refusing to acknowledge any non-religious basis for being right. And that is why I think the atheist questioner earlier expressed his frustration that on the right I only see these values defended through a religious lens. And he's got a point. While there are certainly a few rational defenders of objectivity and truth, in terms of numbers we hear a lot more voices on the right speaking through their various religious lenses. So while I'm delighted that many of them are finally awakening to the polarity of left and right, and to the realization that truth is objective and not subjective, I remain somewhat frustrated when I see their conclusions determined by intrinsicism. I'm tempted to say that their arguments are intrinsically subjective, the intrinsicism relating to their belief itself, and the subjectivism relating to their choosing intrinsicism over objectivism. In any case, for our part, we'll continue to promote and defend what we have objectively reasoned to be just right when you join us again next week as we continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
I was talking with Cornel West, he was on my show, and I was like, hey, why do you always call Donald Trump a fascist, but you never call Joe Biden a fascist? And he said, that's because he tried to overthrow the government on January 6th. And I was like, really? You think a bunch of Second Amendment gun nuts showed up at the Capitol to overthrow the government, and son of a bitch, they forgot their fucking guns. Isn't that weird? I bet they were embarrassed. All right, we're going into the Capitol. Mikey, give me the guns. Ah! Oh, I brought mittens. People say the dumbest things about January 6th. They go, I'm like, why do you think they... They go, well, Jimmy, I'm sorry, but January 6th undermined our democracy. That's what you think did it? You know, we don't live in a democracy. We live in an oligarchy, which was proven by a Princeton study over 10 years ago, because corporations hijacked your democracy over 50... 50- years ago, which is why workers haven't had a raise since 1980. When are you going to get pissed off about that?